Boyd. Up next on Think, there's a new movie in theaters about the quiet children's television phenomenon known as Mr. Rogers. We'll spend the hour with the award-winning journalist whose article inspired the film. As Tom Juneau will tell us, he was assigned to write about Fred Rogers in part as an exercise in irony. Rogers was, by all accounts, genuinely kind and gentle. Juneau had made a name for himself as an acerbic writer who wasn't afraid to cut his subjects down to size. He never expected Rogers to become a real and trusted friend, one who not only changed Juneau's work, but how he saw himself as a person. Our conversation starts after a short break. Was in some ways a creation. The gentle man who changed into play clothes as he greeted small children each day was addressing them from a TV studio in Pittsburgh.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
In slow, deliberate cadence over 31 seasons, Fred Rogers explained things, reminded his viewers that they were special, and occasionally disappeared into the puppet-ruled land of make-believe. When the real-life Fred Rogers stepped off the set, he brought that extraordinary empathy with him into the world. But before you write the man off as simply nice, journalist Tom Juneau wants you to understand something essential. Mr. Rogers demanded something of nearly everyone he interacted with. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom Juneau is a journalist and the recipient of 2 National Magazine Awards. The new movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, is based on his 1998 profile of Fred Rogers and the friendship between them that grew out of it. That piece was titled, Can You Say Hero? Fred Rogers has been doing the same small good thing for a very long time, and it's available on the Esquire magazine website. Tom Juneau joins us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
At the time that you profiled Fred Rogers in 1998, you would have seemed like the last person in the world to take this story. How did you get the assignment?
Well, I think the fact that I was the unlikely profiler of Fred Rogers sort of made me the profiler of Fred Rogers. I was working for Esquire. I had really just come there. I had come there from GQ in 1997. And sort of immediately developed a reputation. I was doing some pretty dark stories, and darkness does rub off, I think, over time, and so it had kind of rubbed off on me.
Did the story that you eventually wrote differ from the one you expected to write going in?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know what the story was going to be when I went in. You know, it was, we were doing a story on a special issue on American Heroes. And, you know, there was an editor there who thought that, and really passionately believed that Fred Rogers, whom he grew up with, you know, was an American hero. But I didn't grow up with Fred Rogers. I was a little bit old for Fred Rogers. And when Fred sort of came into the national scene, I was 12 years old, and, you know, and frankly, I frankly scoffed and sneered at Fred Rogers because, you know, I was, you know, too tough and too cool and too, you know, 12-year-old macho, whatever that is for that. So, I didn't know what to make of Fred. You know, Fred existed, you know, Fred was more real to me in the Eddie Murphy Saturday Night Live parody version than he was in as a, you know, beloved children's TV show, much less an American hero. And, I met Fred in New York City for the first, you know, when I first met him, it was in New York City. And, I pretty much found out right away that he was not going to be what I expected. he was, you know, instantly, sort of interesting simply because he didn't fit any mold that I was used to or accustomed to.
Did you understand when he agreed to the interview that he didn't do a lot of interactions as extensive as the one that he agreed to with you?
I'm not certain how extensive he thought it was going to be, you know, to be honest with you. So the first time I met Fred, as I said, was in New York City. But, you know, the Esquire offices at the time were on 55th Street on the west side. And I had been in communication with Family Communications, which was Fred's, you know, production company. And I had somehow, you know, I think I'd written them a letter explaining what I wanted to do. And, you know, somehow I had gotten his phone number. And so I called Fred, and, you know, to my to my amazement, he answered the phone. And of course, you know, you hear that voice, mm-hmm. and, you know, and you're immediately in both, you know, familiar ground and complete terra incognita. You know, it's because it's you don't know how well you know that voice until you're listening to that voice on the other end of the phone. And so I said, you know, Fred, I'd love to come and see you. And he goes, well, Tom, I'm right around the corner. And he goes, but I have to tell you, I was just taking a nap, so I'm in my robe and slippers. And so I said, well, you know, can I come over? And so I walked over there. I mean, it took me, you know, literally 2 minutes. And I walked over there and I knocked on the door, and a door opens up, and there he is in his robe and slippers was Fred Rogers in this sort of, you know, kind of small New York City apartment. And then, you know, it just started right there. I mean, there was nothing familiar about it, you know, from the very beginning. I sat down. He asked me. I think I might have asked him, you know, about his own childhood, and he immediately turned that around. I didn't know it at the time, but he wasn't going to answer a single one of my questions. Hmm. He immediately turned that around and asked me about, you know, the bunny rabbit that I had as a boy.
What's interesting about that, not only, you know, you were supposed to be interviewing him and he kind of turned the tables, but it sounds like a pretty simple question, but it's remarkably personal at the same time.
Well, I think that was Fred's, you know, secret. I mean, he used simplicity, but he was not simple, nor was what he was trying to get at. I mean, simplicity was his lever, you know? I mean, like Archimedes, like move the world with a lever. And I think that, you know, Fred moved the world with his simplicity. You know, I think that one of the great misunderstood phrases in American life is you are special. Hmm. You know, Fred had deep, deep meaning behind it. We could probably devote the better part of this broadcast to the meaning behind that. But, and it was the same way. I mean, did you have a favorite toy, Tom? You know, yes, Fred, his name was Old Rabbit. I'll bet he was a very young rabbit once too, Tom, you know, and it was just like that. And it's, you know, it was hypnotic and it was, but it was also, you know, and it's weird and way profound because he was trying to get at something. He was trying to get at something within me, and he was trying to do that within the first 20 minutes of us meeting.
He did have really warm memories of his parents, and I have no reason to believe they weren't lovely people. But your story also made me wonder, did he idealize them? Did he choose to see their best qualities as the essence of who they were and whatever bad ones they had as explainable and forgivable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question because, I mean, Fred loved his parents and he loved or professed to love his home life. But Fred was one of those people that you meet and, you know, I mean, if you were told or if you learned that he had had a completely traumatic childhood, it would have made at least as much sense, probably much more sense than the happy childhood he professed.
He was, I mean, how was he in school? Was he popular? Was he unpopular?
I mean, what I understand was, I think that he was popular. If you take a look at, you know, some of like the, you know, what's been, you know, preserved, you know, like high school yearbook kind mm-hmm. of things from over the years. It seems like he was popular, but I also know that he had the experience of being bullied. He was, you know, I mean, he talks about it in or Tom Hanks as Fred talks about it in the movie that he was a chubby kid. He was a kind of a coddled kid. He was the richest kid in town. And, you know, bullies used to chase him and call him Fat Freddy. And he spent a lot of times He spent a lot of times indoors, you know, beginning his relationship with those puppets that he brought out and, you know, kind of communicated through to the world.
As an adult, he was highly disciplined about his weight. Like, it became like almost a talisman for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did he decide those numbers meant, 143 pounds?
Yeah, so, I mean, I didn't know about any of this until I accompanied him one morning in Pittsburgh, because that was the, you know, I met him in New York, and then I took a trip to Pittsburgh and accompanied him to his morning swim, which was another story that we could devote the better part of this broadcast to. But after his swim, he stepped on the scale, and it was one of those old, it was at the the Downtown Athletic Club in Pittsburgh, and mm-hmm. it was one of those old scales where you step on it and it has the big almost like clock-like face with the needle, and the needle swung to 143 at like true north, you know. And he was like, well, that's good, you know, because I'm 143. And I was like, so are you trying to lose weight, Fred? And he was like, oh no, you know, I weigh 143 pounds every day. And you know, just the idea of that is almost if you read it in fiction, you wouldn't believe it, you know. And yet, as far as I can understand, you know, every day he stepped on that scale, he weighed 143 pounds, and he to him it meant something. It signified, and because he looked at 143 as this mystical number, because it was the precise amount of letters required to say "I love you," you know, one for I, et cetera, et cetera. And that was also his AOL address was ZZZ, all in caps, 143, the ZZZ signifying that he was a man who slept through the night, and 143 meaning I love you. So, you know, it wasn't that he was not aware of his distinction. I think that he was very confident about saying people were special, because I think that he knew that he was special too.
One thing you discovered that wasn't readily apparent in his TV presence was that he was a deeply religious person.
Mm, right.
How did that manifest itself in his everyday life?
Well, it manifested himself. I mean, speaking of ZZZ 143, I mean, it manifested itself every morning when he woke up from his deep sleep. He, you know, woke up every morning and you know, devoted at least an hour to reading, to writing, and mostly to prayer. He, you know, had a long list of people that he prayed for, you know, by name. And he, you know, made it known to me that he was praying for me and praying for members of my family.
He started instantly referring to you as his new friend.
Mm-hmm, right, right. Yeah, instantly.
Did that strike you as strange in the moment? Did you think that this has got to be a put-on?
Sure. Completely. You know, I mean, it was just like, you know, oh, okay. And I think that, you know, in the movie, you know, Matthew Rhys, you know, plays a character who is, you know, he's angrier or more overtly angry than I was or am, and so it bothers him, whereas I think that I was just more befuddled. It was just like, what's going on here? Who is this? You know, where is this, you know, person, you know, trying to lead me? And I think that I was aware of some of that from the very beginning.
My guest is journalist Tom Juneau. The feature film, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, is based on a piece he wrote about his friendship with Fred Rogers. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero. No, not at all.
What about Mr. Rogers? Is he a hero?
I don't understand the question.
Well, there's you, Fred, and then there's the character you play, Mr. Rogers.
You said it was a play at the plate. Is that what happened to you?
I'm here to interview you, Mr. Rogers.
Well, that is what we're doing, isn't it?
This is Think. I'm Chris Boy. That's a cut from the feature film A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood that opens today, based on the article Can You Say Hero? By my guest, journalist Tom Juneau, a two-time winner of National Magazine Award. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You did request that the character that Matthew Rhys plays has a name different than yours. Why is that?
Well, because there are fundamental differences between his biography and the cause of his troubled soul than my biography and the cause at that time of my troubled soul. So there are lots of similarities, especially the way that Matthew plays us. But there's some really basic differences. I mean, the movie begins with, the character getting into a fight with his father. I never had that kind of physical fight. I never was estranged from my dad. I had a really complicated father and a really complicated relationship with him, but it wasn't like that exactly. I mean, and it wasn't, it was the explanation for the complexities was different. In the movie, the father has left Lloyd and his mother while his mother was dying of cancer. And my mom outlasted my father to her great satisfaction. So it was just different, and there were just some there were some fundamental things that I felt like I couldn't put under my own name. That said, when I see the movie, the differences mean so little to me. The similarities mean everything.
As someone who has spent a career sort of creating versions of people for the consumption of readers, it has to be strange to put yourself in that same position.
Yeah, strange. I guess strange is the word. I've been trying over the last few weeks to figure out the word, because some people say strange or surreal. The question that I always ask myself is am I that transparent? because Matthew, you always think that when you do a story that no matter how positive or negative it would be, that you always think that I want to make sure that the person who I'm writing about knows that I knew him and that I nailed him, mm-hmm. and Matthew nailed me. when I saw Matthew for the first time after I'd seen the movie, I was joking with him. I was like, so Matthew, what was the hardest part about playing Tom Juneau? And he was like, your walk. And I was like, what? and he said, yeah, you have a hard walk. And I've gone a whole lifetime without thinking that or knowing that I have a walk, but I guess I do. And it's actors who can see that about you. They know your tells, like don't play poker with an actor because they're trained to see all of that stuff. The way that you touch your nose, the way that you tilt your head, the way that you walk, they get all that and they can reproduce it. And seeing it it's like beyond strange or surreal. It's you kind of enter a different zone.
So Fred Rogers was instantly recognizable when he went out in public, and he was approachable, so people approached him. How did he handle those interactions?
Fred had the gift, the talent, the genius, I think, for meeting people one-on-one. Didn't matter who that person was. It didn't matter how many of them there were. I mean, he was He was used to speaking to an audience of millions every day as if there was one person in that audience, and he was, you know, talking directly into that person's ear, that child's ear. And it was the same with him on the street. I mean, he was swarmed by people. And one after another, he would engage that person at some sort of deep and personal level. It was that was the thing that, you know, when I saw him in New York City and I saw him speak to just children in a way that sort of validated and at the same time disarmed them, that was like the light bulb moment for me.
What did people want from him?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that validation is definitely one of those things. I mean, you know, people want to be heard and they want to be seen. And that's what he did. He heard them and he saw them.
What did he want from them?
Ah, that's the mystery. Because I'm one of the people that he heard and saw. So I've asked this question a lot, and I've especially asked it a lot over the last several months, and where I've done really little but write, think, and talk about Fred Rogers. And that question of what he wanted from me, you know, why he chose me as a friend is, and he definitely chose me as a friend, there's no doubt about it, you know, has been mysterious to me. I mean, one answer is that I got lucky. Another answer is that he did it to, you know, any number of people. I was certainly not the only one he did it to. But then, you know, I mean, it's, you know, he wanted me to know at the time when I was doubting it that I was good and trustworthy, that there was something essentially good in me. And I think that he believed that of all people. But I think that he knew the people in particular who didn't believe it of themselves. And I think that he wanted me to believe it.
So in the movie, there's this exchange that I gather didn't happen quite that way in real life. But Tom Hanks says, and Matthew Reese are talking, and Matthew Reese says, you sort of decided to be my friend because I'm broken. It almost sounds like he decided to be your friend because you were redeemable.
Yeah, I mean, I do believe that Fred thought that everybody was redeemable. I mean, you know, one of the things that's been, you know, wonderful about this whole experience and this whole experience of sort of talking about Fred as a function of this, the release of this movie, has been, you know, just a great thing for me. But, you know, he sent me a lot of emails, and we had a long and deep email correspondence that lasted for, you know, until he died, from the moment I met him until he died. And in those letters, in those emails, he was much more overtly spiritual. And he never mentioned God on his show, but he mentioned it, you know, often in my letters. And he always said in those letters, you know, God will never give up on you. You know, that he will always be there for you, always, no matter what.
You say that he believed in goodness as firmly as he believed in God, which is an interesting way to put it, because there are two ways of thinking about faith, right? It can be a sort of divine gift, or it can be a choice. Do you know which one it was for him?
I don't know, but I do know that Fred made choices. I know that really he was all about choices. It's one of the things that I really love about the movie, in that it doesn't show it as a divine gift. It shows faith as a choice. He worked really, really hard at everything. I mean, I do believe like the 143 thing to me is that almost, you know, puts him in, you know, that he came from Krypton and came to the planet because, you know, our sun, you know, had superpowers here because the sun is different. But the fact is that he, you know, worked extraordinarily hard at it and made choices and, you know, was unflagging in his pursuit of not even personal goodness, but of convincing people that they in turn, you know, had some ownership of personal goodness. And the movie captures that, as well as the cost of that. at the cost of that kind of discipline.
Yeah. Did he show signs that his willingness to stop and to listen and to share kind thoughts took a toll on him?
You just knew it. You know, I don't think that it was like, oh my God, this is tough. I mean, there's a really wonderful back and forth where, you know, Lloyd Vogel, Matthew Rhys asked him about the burden. And I think that those questions were all quite true to the questions that I asked. Because you just sensed it, you know, you sensed it, you felt it in the pace that he slowed everything down to. You just kind of sense that this is not something that is, you know, spontaneous. That it's, I mean, he was a spontaneous person. I mean, he delighted in jokes, mischief, being the butt of practical jokes. All those things just delighted him. He liked to laugh. He, you know, all that kind of stuff. He was not as studied a character as he is in the movie. There was a lot of laughter on the set there, but there was that sense of that he was slowing things down because he was exerting a force of will in pursuit of somehow expressing God's will.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As you might have seemed an unlikely person initially to write about him, he was in many ways an unlikely person to end up one of the most recognizable faces in American culture. His first impression of TV, particularly TV for kids, was that he really did not care for it.
Yeah, that's right. He went into television because I think that the television of the 1950s that he saw, you know, filled him with distaste. And, you know, I mean, he had a very, very consistent idea of what the media should be. And we know that because he came to media as a reformer. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he was not a dogmatic human being whatsoever. He never proselytized on that show. He never even mentioned God, despite the sort of the sacred program, you know, that he had in mind. But he was pretty dogmatic about television, and he was pretty dogmatic about that he didn't like the message. He didn't particularly like the method of that was being used. I mean, the use of television as a distraction, the use of television as a place where, you know, your eye was just sort of continually being moved around. It's something that he was completely against, and the thing that he was, you know, his show was the answer to that. His show was like his answer to all his criticisms, because the show embodied what he thought the television should be.
So in 1997, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award. I just want to play a bit of his Emmy acceptance speech.
So many people have helped me to come to this night. Some of you are here. Some are far away. Some are even in heaven. All of us have special ones who have loved us into being. Would you just take, along with me, 10 seconds to think of the people who have helped you become who you are? Those who have cared about you and wanted what was best for you in life. 10 seconds of silence. I'll watch the time. Whomever you've been thinking about, how pleased they must be to know the difference you feel they've made. You know, they're the kind of people television does well to offer our world.
What's so astonishing about that, Tom, is I've never heard an acceptance speech that is less about the person being honored.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, it's a remarkable thing. There's so many remarkable things. I mean, to me, the most remarkable thing, the thing that I hear the first, is the laughter. People think it's funny at first. By the end of that 10 seconds, they do not think it's funny. And because I've seen that. And, you know, Fred sometimes, you know, and often asked for more than 10 seconds. He asked for a minute. And he counted just the way he did there. And the thing that about Fred is that this is, you know, I know that this was part of your introduction, but he was not just a nice man. He was a man, he was in his own incredibly, you know, kind-hearted, soft-spoken way. He was an authority figure. People did do what he asked them to do. I know that because I did what he asked me to do. And it's just, you know, absolutely, you know, remarkable that people, he asked them to go there, and they did.
What did he ask of you?
Well, you know, it's, you know, when I, so I just wrote this story for the Atlantic Monthly about Fred and the movie and our friendship and where Fred might stand in today's culture. And, you know, after the first draft, there was a part where I said, I don't know what he was asking of me. And, you know, my editor at the Atlantic, Denise Wills, she's this wonderful, wonderful editor. She asked, you know, you might want to think a little bit more about that for the second draft. And so I did. And what happened was that I happened to read the first story again for the first time in a really long time. And I, when I got down to the end of it, I was like, oh, he was leading me towards prayer. And sort of, I think that that's ultimately what he wanted me to do.
My guest is journalist Tom Juneau. We're talking about the article that inspired A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the feature film about Mr. Rogers and a character based on Juneau. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
I like you as you are. Exactly and precisely, I think you turned out nicely, and I like you as you are. I like you as you are, without a doubt or question, or even a suggestion, 'cause I like you as you are.
This is Thank. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Fred Rogers singing on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. My guest this hour is journalist Tom Juneau. The feature film about Tom Juneau and Fred Rogers' relationship with a fictionalized version of Juneau is called A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It opens nationwide today. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Here's something that I've been trying to figure out, Tom. Mr. Rogers, as you say, has never been in this Atlantic piece more revered. We love him. I mean, I'm in my extreme 40s, so I am of the era of people who grew up on Mr. Rogers. But how is it that he is so widely loved and admired today in a culture that has grown ever more cynical and quick to judge and lambast?
Well, because I think that we all have a conscience that's, you know, quite aware of that where we're going is not such a great place, you know, in terms of, you know, how we, you know, behave when we're communicating with each other on, you know, especially, you know, on new mediums. And so I think that it probably makes us really profoundly uncomfortable. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, you hear about the frog and the boiling water. Hmm. If the water is turned up slow enough that the frog thinks it's, you know, doesn't have to get out. Well, I think this is, you know, a moment when we're starting to look around and wondering if maybe we should get out, because It's uncomfortable going online and pounding people, or, you know, watching people get pounded, or getting pounded yourself or whatever. And, you know, I think that to me, Fred is has kind of, this movie is there to sort of ask us to maybe either get out of that pot or put on the brakes if we're driving too fast. I mean, I do believe that, you know, that he's coming, you know, to the fore right now because we miss him.
I mean, there's two ways of sort of accepting the challenge that he gave us all. One, you know, it starts with loving yourself and recognizing that each one of us is special and deserving of love. Mm-hmm. The harder part, of course, that you kind of put your finger on here is that he also felt that way about everyone else, including the people we revile and the people right. we are sure are ruining everything. He believed they were special and worthy of love as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, one of his most powerful statements, and yeah, I mean, and also one of his most useful statements is, you know, you were a child once too. Because I think that, I mean, I know that I use that as a parent, you know, when I'm, you know, having trouble, you know, with my daughter, and I'm like, oh, you know, she should do it this way. I'll, you know, I think back to when I was that age, to when I was 16, and, you know, was I getting up in the morning and doing jumping jacks and, you know, and reading
taking
Shakespeare?
Taking out the trash.
I was not, right. You know, and that's, it's just a, you know, it's a powerful reminder, and it's a powerful reminder when turned not just on yourself or those close to you, but on other people too. I mean, you know, Donald Trump was a child once too. And you know, and or anybody that you care to name as a you know as a target, and you know if you have the discipline to think like that, it just sort of begins to change some things.
Did your friendship with him change the way you write about your other subjects?
I mean, I don't know if my other subjects would think of it like that, but I do think that there's a, you know, there's a before and after in my writing, a before in Fred and after Fred, and I do think that what Fred did was show me that, you know, that goodness is just as interesting as you know, as evil. Good is just as interesting as evil, and that goodness is just as mysterious in its own way, maybe even more mysterious, maybe even more perplexing, you know, as you know, badness. And I do think that you see that in, you know, my work after Fred. I mean obviously, I mean, you know Fred gave me he had like a list of precepts that about journalism, and the screenwriters for the movie found that list of precepts in the file that he kept on me, you know, in his archive, and he never shared those precepts with me ever. He never was dogmatic about them. But I mean, and so I don't even know why that list was there. But that list was, you know, basically, you know, point out injustice if you have to, point out goodness when you can. You're not an automaton. You're not a stenographer, and that you should be somehow cognizant of the awe in the world. And, you know, I was told about this that just this summer when I was actually, you know, writing the Atlantic story. And I looked at that, and I asked myself, you know, since meeting Fred, do I live up to those standards? And, you know, and the answer is I think I do. And I think that, you know, Fred communicated that to me the way he communicated just about everything, which was, you know, by example.
Yeah, it's such a gift. I was thinking, you know, considering the movie and reading the piece from 1998 and the one that you've just written, you know, there are some people that I've lost in my life that I miss every day, but our relationships were complete enough that although I miss them, I know how they would respond to things that are happening in my life. I know what mm-hmm. they would want me to do. And it sounds like even over just knowing him for 4 years, he gave you that.
Yeah, he did. You know, I think that, you know, Fred would, you know, send me emails, you know, Tom, you're coming closer to the eternal, you know, I think that you'll never forget that presence, or Tom, you know that I'm still praying for you and this and that. And, in the emails, he was much more overtly religious or spiritual than he was, you know, in his show or even in his one-to-one interactions.
So it occurs to you that we have collectively failed him, right? Failed to value compassion over judgment, forgiveness over resentment, listening over speaking, patience over frustration. Is it too late to pull those values back into the culture, or are they there but just not celebrated?
I think that's a great question, because a lot of people have come up to me and said, you know, that I know there are Fred Rogerses in my life. And there's, you know, they just don't have the media presence. They just don't have TV shows. And I think that's not just a valid counterweight to what I've been saying, but a necessary one. But I think that the point with Fred is that he did have a vast audience, and he did have a platform, and he chose to use it for this. I mean, he has, my guess is that he has, you know, many more successors in terms of following a path of kindness than we could ever know. But the question is whether he has successors in these mediums that affect us so deeply.
What do you remember about the last time you spoke to him?
Well, the last time I spoke to him was on Christmas Day, 2002. And the night before Christmas Eve, a cousin had called me. My cousin had been drinking, and he was mad at me, and he was mad at me for not attending his father's funeral the year before, because I loved his father, and but I had a deadline for a story that I'd been working on for a long time, and it was one I had to meet, and so I chose to meet the deadline rather than to go to the funeral. And he was really, really angry about it, and he called up, and my wife answered the phone, my wife Janet, and he took it out on her. We eventually spoke, and he took it out on me too, but you know, it affected my wife deeply, and she couldn't sleep that night, and she finally went to sleep by asking, you know, what would Fred do? And I, Christmas morning, you know, I called him and told him that story. And, you know, what Fred said was, you know, it was so Fred. He was just like, how like you, Tom, how like you to call me on Christmas morning, how like you to tell me that story. And, you know, I didn't know at the time that he was already sick and that he was already dying. And he did not tell me. I wrote in the Atlantic story that I was the kind of friend who told him things. I was not the kind of friend he told things to. And, you know, that was the last thing. One of the things that's made me happiest over the last several months is when the Atlantic story came out, Joanne called me.
His wife.
And she's a remarkable person who speaks Fred. and she called up, and I didn't answer. I was doing something else. But she left me a message, and she said, "How like you, Tom." So.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Was Fred Rogers a happy person, do you think, or would you use some other word?
That's a great question. I think he was, because I think that he was committed to a purpose. And I think that he was executing that purpose. I think that he was embodying that purpose. And, you know, I think that level of commitment, you know, I mean, obviously it breeds frustration, but I think that, I mean, can there be any higher form of happiness than that?
the documentary that came out a year or so ago, Won't You Be My Neighbor, had kind of almost a throwaway line from one of Fred Rogers' sons that referred very briefly to what it was like to have like a saint for a father.
Yeah.
What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, I know that I never met James or John until the premiere for that documentary. That was not, you know, like I was, you know, I got to know Joanne, but I never got to know them. So they were, you know, not part of that public aspect of his life. And I, you know, listen, fathers are fathers, you know, and I had a really, you know, I had a very complicated relationship with my dad. Fred, you know, in some ways became a father figure to me because he represented a choice that offered a difference. You know, Fred was very, very different from my father. So I gravitated towards my towards him. You know, I'm sure that he was a complicated figure to his own sons. I have no doubt about that.
It's got to be hard when your father loves everyone
in that way, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I mean, James went to the premiere the other night in Pittsburgh, and he sat with Joanne, and I mean, I was apprehensive is not the right word, but I really wanted him to like the movie, and I really wondered if watching the movie was going to be, you know, kind of, you know, all right for him, and Joanne said that it was, and that he liked the movie, but it must have been kind of tough, you know, watching how close Fred, you know, got to the people who entered his life by other means.
Tom Juneau is a journalist and the recipient of two National Magazine Awards. The new movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, is based on his 1998 profile of Fred Rogers and the friendship that grew out of it. Tom, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity. It was great.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. We hope that you'll subscribe to our podcast using your favorite podcast app. And you can learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.